And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
You long-faced, overdressed anarchist!
Welcome to the second hour of this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Up next, an LGBT news magazine I bring you each and every week called This Way Out. That'll be followed by a whole bunch of shorter pieces that could not fit into the first hour, which include but not limited to Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Women's Zine News, Peak Oil Check-In, just to name a few. That's the type of alternative non-corporate voices you get each and every week here on this Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
The only time I'm comfortable is when I'm on stage. When I'm on stage, I'm really comfortable and easy and in the moment of being on stage. But the minute I get off stage, I get really rageful and angry about the state of the world.
We just can't afford to keep these lies going. We can't afford to be stigmatizing and ostracizing same-sex loving people in our community because it's killing us. So hopefully Noah's Ark helps to change that.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Razor-thin margins mark U.S. marriage rights campaigns. Delaria jazzes it up and jokes around. And a TV series jumps the broom to the box office. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Lee Moore.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 25th, 2008. LGBT advocates in the U.S. are in their final pushes to defeat anti-lesbi-gay ballot measures in four states on November 4th. In what is probably the most closely watched non-candidate battle in the general elections, Californians will consider Proposition 8, a measure to overturn the state Supreme Court ruling in support of same-gender marriages and constitutionally ban them. The latest polls suggest that the vote will be extremely close. In what may be the best of what some LGBT critics have called a weak TV advertising strategy, California State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jack O'Connell is featured in the latest No 1-8 ad, condemning as absolutely untrue and shameless charges by its proponents in their ads that young school children will be forced to learn about same-gender marriage if the measure isn't passed. The Prop 8 campaign continues to use scare tactics and lies to bolster their campaign, O'Connell says in the ad. It's despicable that children are being used for political gain.
Leaders of Yes on 8 this week sent letters to several businesses that have donated to the No campaign, threatening to publish their names and demanding that they make equal donations to ProtectMarriage.com, the umbrella group supporting the measure. Were you to elect not to donate comparably, the certified letters read, it would be a clear indication that you are in opposition to traditional marriage. Executive Director Jeffrey Kors of Equality California, which is spearheading the No on 8 effort, called it an outrageous attempt to extort people. None of the targeted businesses appear to be complying. In what some analysts say is the costliest social issue campaign in U.S. history, by some accounts the total spending by both sides has topped $50 million, the Yes on 8 campaign has been largely funded by the Roman Catholic-based fraternal organization Knights of Columbus, the notoriously anti-queer Focus on the Family, and thousands of Mormon church members. Californians Against Hate, a group formed to fight Proposition 8, claimed that, according to a September 20th report in the Wall Street Journal, Mormon church members have been told that their souls would be in jeopardy if they don't donate to the Yes campaign.
Voters in Arizona in 2006 made it the first and only state to defeat a proposal to outlaw same-gender marriage. 29 others had passed marriage bans by that time. But the ballot initiative 2 years ago would have also banned domestic partnerships, often preferred by senior citizen couples who could lose government benefits if they married or remarried. And that aspect is largely believed to have contributed to the measure's 4-point loss. But Proposition 102, a more narrow ballot initiative on this year's Arizona ballot, bans just same-gender marriage. According to Time magazine, its proponents have raised more than $7 million, seven times the amount raised in their 2006 loss, and 70 times the amount that opponents have raised. According to Californians Against Hate, Mormon church members have also largely bankrolled the Yes campaign in Arizona. In better news for opponents, the state's largest newspaper, the Arizona Republic, this week urged a no vote in its editorial pages. Public opinion polls show that, like California, the outcome in Arizona is too close to call.
According to the latest polls in Florida, voters favor a constitutional ban there by 57%. Constitutional amendments, however, require a supermajority in Florida of 60%. And in addition to outlawing same-gender marriage, Amendment 2 states that no other legal union that is treated as marriage or the substantial equivalent thereof shall be valid or recognized. Opponents say that would deny domestic partner benefits not only to same-gender couples but also to unmarried couples who live together. They're hoping that the state's significant senior citizen population and the fact that a 60% vote is required to pass the measure will work in their favor.
And a poll in Arkansas predicts that Act 1, which would prevent any unmarried couple from adopting or caring for a foster child, will lose. It requires a simple 50% vote to pass. According to the latest Arkansas poll, 55% oppose the measure, while 38% are in favor. Supporters say that Act 1 is needed to prevent gays and lesbians from adopting children in the state. But Jane Perry, the poll's director, said that it seems to me that many Arkansans, both liberals and conservatives, are uncomfortable dictating the family arrangements of others, whether they agree with them or not.
In other news from around the world, officials in Tambov, Russia, after giving initial approval, reversed course and banned the city's first ever public LGBT events, which had been scheduled for October 9th. City officials claim that residents did not approve of such a march and rally, that police couldn't guarantee security, and that there would be traffic problems. Moscow gay activist Nikolai Alexeev, who was involved in planning the events, said the reversal violates the Russian Constitution and the European Convention on Human Rights, and that organizers will take legal action against the city. Tambov is about 500 kilometers southeast of Moscow and has a population of about 292,000. Earlier this year, Mayor Oleg Betin reportedly said that faggots should be torn apart and their pieces thrown to the wind.
Officials in Krakow, Poland also approved a lesbi-gay march and then also banned it after Polish President Lech Kaczynski announced plans to attend city independence celebrations on the same day. LGBT activists had planned a March of Rainbow Tolerance on October 31st to the grave of King Vladislaw III, whom some historians say was gay, on the anniversary of his birth, or death. There were conflicting reports about that. City officials were originally comfortable with the march and Independence Day events occurring simultaneously. But after Kaczynski's announcement, they banned all other street events and demonstrations for the day and said the king's grave would be closed. Kaczynski, who as mayor of Warsaw banned that city's 2004 and 2005 pride parades, has said that if homosexuality were to be promoted on a grand scale, the human race would disappear, and that he opposes propagating gay orientation. Gay activist Lukasz Paluki said of Kaczynski that, "Information about our meeting was in the biggest Polish media, so I am sure he knew about our march."
An Islamic body in Malaysia has banned lesbian sex and what it calls masculine conduct by female Muslims. The National Fatwa Council's chair, Abdul Shakur Hussein, told reporters that it is unacceptable to see women who love the male lifestyle, including dressing in the clothes men wear. It becomes clear when they start to have sex with someone of the same gender, that is, woman and woman. The country of 27 million people is governed by two different judicial systems: Sharia courts to address Muslim civil matters and secular courts, which apply to the 40% minority in Malaysia who are not Muslim. Section 377 of the Malaysian Penal Code outlaws sodomy, punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim has twice been charged with that crime, which he says was done to discredit him. The same law is still in force in other former British colonies, including India, where it's currently being challenged in the Delhi High Court and in Singapore. Malaysia additionally punishes gross indecency with another male person with up to 2 years in prison. Cross-dressing is also illegal. LGBT advocates worry that the new fatwa may lead to a specific law in Malaysia making lesbian sex a crime.
But lesbians have apparently gained equal access to fertility treatment in Britain under legislation approved by an almost 3-to-1 margin in the House of Commons this week. According to a report by PinkNews.com, the Human Fertilization and Embryology Bill now returns to the House of Lords for a final reading before it becomes law. The legislation will make it easier for lesbians and single women to get National Health Service fertilization assistance and allow lesbian or gay couples to be named on birth certificates as the legal parents of their children.
And the head of the British Army, General Richard Danat, made history by addressing an LGBT conference in London earlier this month. In remarks to the fourth joint conference on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual matters, Danat said that we have made real progress in our understanding of equality and diversity in the military context, and there is a desire to achieve more yet. Respect for others, he said, is not an optional extra. It is a command responsibility and an essential part of leadership, teamwork, and operational effectiveness. Britain's armed forces lifted their lesbi-gay ban in 2000, following a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights ordering the change.
And finally, Sweden's Court of Appeal has refused to hear a kennel owner's appeal of a discrimination case she lost after refusing to sell a puppy to a customer because she was in a lesbian relationship. The woman had mentioned her partner during a phone call to the kennel owner, asking about a puppy advertised for sale. The owner then refused to sell the puppy to her. The kennel owner must now pay 20,000 kroner, about $2,000, in damages. The Swedish Constitution bans discrimination based on sexual orientation. According to the English-language newspaper The Local, in her explanation for denying the woman her puppy, the kennel owner made reference to earlier contacts she'd had with transvestite couples, saying she'd read that transvestites are connected to animal pornography.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 25th, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Lee Moore.
Noah's story arc continues on the big screen later in the program. Notoriously open lesbian comic Leah Delaria became famous doing stand-up, then movies, then Broadway, then jazz. And now she's doing all of the above. In anticipation of her doing Australia, she chatted with This Way Out Brisbane correspondent John Frame about her performing life and about, of all people, Sarah Palin.
Color me a color, baby. Color me a color. Color me a color, darling. I know who you are. Come up off your color chart. I know where you're coming from.
Leah Delaria, welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Fantastic. Happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to know that you're coming to visit Brisbane to be part of the Brisbane Jazz Festival.
I'm actually doing Sydney, Adelaide, Melbourne, and Brisbane. So four of the five big cities.
I first saw you in the film The Edge of 17. And Angie was really sweet. Do you find that you identify closely with Angie in that respect?
Not that's why I'm laughing. So, my reputation is so completely and utterly different from that. You know, I'm like the bad girl lesbian comic, and Ellen is the good girl. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm down and dirty and grungy and so on. But the thing is, when I come to Brisbane, what will be different is that it won't be comedy. It's going to be pure singing in support of my new record that's come out in the Warner Jazz label.
Mm-hmm. The Ballad of Sweeney Todd, released as a single. Hey, from Play It Cool, and you really nail it.
Thank you, thank you. I mean, that particular, the Ballad of Sweeney Todd was kind of the whole reason that I got into the world of jazz. It was just something that I put together, and I went on stage at Carnegie Hall when they were doing this tribute to Stephen Sondheim, a jazz tribute to Stephen Sondheim, and I went and did that number, and stopped the show, and Stephen came backstage and had a nice long conversation with me, which was totally awesome.
Wow.
And then the A&R representative from Warner Brothers was behind him and said, let's give you a four-record deal. It was amazing.
Okay.
Changed my life.
Uh-huh. But if you've had this other life as a comedian, as mm-hmm. you know, such a notorious, perhaps, stand-up comedian, does that then influence much of what an audience really expects when they turn up to your shows?
Not really, because, you know, what happened was I was a kind of stand-up comic that was loud and brash and in your face, you know what I mean? And people could only take about 5 minutes of it, and then they'd be like, Mommy, make it stop. It's too much. It's too loud. It's too fast. It's too, you know, wild. So what I always did was I would sing a song. After about 15 minutes, 10 minutes comedy, I would sing a song. I would sing a jazz song. I usually had a trio on stage with me or a quartet. And then I would, like, kind of lull the audience into this kind of false sense of security before I would start screaming at them again. So I was always a comic who sang. And after I got the lead in the On the Town on Broadway, the Broadway Revival, and then, of course, Rocky Horror Show in Chicago and the other shows that I've done on Broadway, I became more known as a singer. And so I've gone from being a stand-up who could sing to being a singer who's funny. So that was like 10 years ago when that happened. So most people, I think, are aware of the fact that my career has progressed.
Okay. Do you find that your working life is more demanding now that you're a vocalist first?
My working life is insane because I do still do stand up, especially now with the political climate in this country and Sarah Palin. Honey, I cannot stop talking about her. And so I do the stand-up, I do the singing, and I'm actually on an American soap opera right now called One Life to Live, so I'm doing a bunch of acting as well. So I'm constantly, when you are as edgy and as butch as I am and look the way that I look and say the things that I say, it's really hard to make a living doing one thing. So I do about five different things, and between them I have a career.
Okay. It must make you feel sort of, you know, comfortable with life.
I'm going to have to say no on that because I'm so kind of over what's going on with queer people right now. And the only time I'm comfortable is when I'm on stage. When I'm on stage, I'm really comfortable and easy and in the moment of being on stage. But the minute I get off stage, I get really rageful and angry about the state of the world.
Okay. So what is it that's happening with queer people in particular that is getting you upset?
I think personally that queer people, that our quote-unquote movement, if we can call it that, has been usurped by a bunch of kind of rich white guys. They've taken us, they talk about these issues that don't mean anything anymore. I mean, like, we're really focusing so hard on gay marriages. Don't get me wrong. I think that if a gay person wants to get married, they should go out and they should get married. And the minute somebody says you can't get married because you're gay, I've got a problem with that. But I like to examine what it is about us that makes us feel the need to imitate straight people. Like our relationships aren't good enough unless they are like theirs. I don't think anybody should get married.
Fair enough. Yeah, and there's enough, I know, young people who certainly absolutely agree with you. You were saying before that you're particularly concerned about Sarah Palin.
I mean, please. Who is this? Where did he find this woman? He was, like, so desperate to find a woman that he went. I mean, I don't know her. She might be a really nice person. My guess is she's not. But, you know, I don't. But that's the biggest issue. I don't know her. I have no idea who she is. She just popped up out of the blue. Where did he find her?
Hmm.
Where did he find her? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she's a gun-toting mama who is against all gay rights. This is how bad she is against gay rights. I got to tell you this. She told a joke in her acceptance speech when she accepted the VP nomination. Well, she told this joke, and the joke was, what's the difference between a soccer mom and a bulldog? And the punchline was lipstick.
Okay.
Well, I know that joke, and the joke is usually, what's the difference between a soccer mom and a bulldike? And the answer is lipstick. So
okay.
Not only is she not going to allow us to get married, she won't even let us tell lesbian jokes. She's a bad thing. She has to go. And, you know, I just want to say to the gay people who are out there to please come to the show. When I talk between songs, I will be funny because I can't help it. It's just not a stand-up focused show. This is a jazz festival. And that's the beauty of being as out as I am, that I can do something as straight-laced and as mainstreamed as the Brisbane Jazz Festival, still be who I am. and still, you know, kick ass at that festival. So it'd be really great to have, like, all these queer people come and just to this really kind of mainstream event, you know, and just show who we are.
It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Liz Olaria.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I cannot wait to see Brisbane.
This Way Out's John Frame in conversation with funny jazz singer Leah Delaria. Her new album is called The Live Smoke Sessions.
We've got good news, bad news, and good news about your favorite international LGBT radio program. The good news is that you can now hear free podcasts of This Way Out. To subscribe, log on to www.thiswayout.org. The bad news is that we're still owed thousands of dollars from our former online outlet, and that puts This Way Out in serious financial jeopardy. Stations get the program from us for free. You can get the podcast for free. Producing and distributing the program, however, is not free. But the other good news is that This Way Out's unique on-the-scene reports covering the fight for same-gender marriage equality from the world's first legal weddings in the Netherlands are now available in a 2-CD collection called Altard States. This Way Out listener supporters can get this and other special programs by visiting our website. Please say, I do, at www.thiswayout.org.
Nearly 2 years after it filmed its last episode, the Landmark Logo Network TV series Noah's Ark just hit the big screen with a bang that even blew out High School Musical 3 in one city. This Way Out, Steve Pride chatted with Daryl Noah Stevens about the series and the film.
Oh, baby, no one else.
It's often said there aren't enough good gay roles in Hollywood, but don't tell that to actor Daryl Stevens. He played Angel, the erotic dance instructor, in another gay movie. Andrew, the sexy roomie of a male escort in Boy Culture, and the title character in the Logo series Noah's Ark, which has transitioned from television to the big screen, with Noah's Ark Jumping the Broom.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens from Noah's Ark Jumping the Broom.
And what is the film about? The
film's about Noah getting married. Noah from Noah's Ark, the TV series, goes to Martha's Vineyard with his lover and his three best friends and their respective partners, and he goes to get married.
What attracted you to Noah originally, besides being a struggling actor and hey, TV?
That was it, really. No. I like Noah's emotional vulnerability. Black male actors don't often get to play characters who get to show emotion, and these guys are not shooting guns, they're not dealing drugs, they're living lives, very sort of domestic, easy, very middle-class lives with their lovers and their friends, and it was kind of an interesting twist on what black men are seen doing on television, so that was kind of exciting. And I think with shows like Queer as Folk and Will and Grace, the main character is the sort of everyman, the sort of Joe White guy, you know? And with this show, Patrick Ian Polk, the creator, didn't really want to give in to that whole idea that the main character needs to be the most bland character. He felt like gay culture had sort of turned on the so-called sissies of the community. And everyone in the gay community was trying to look like straight guys. For black men, it was trying to look like thugs. And for white guys, it was trying to look like Abercrombie jocks, you know. So I think he really wanted to turn that whole idea around and make the hero a so-called sissy and stop vilifying those gay men who are comfortable in their skin being themselves.
Even after playing gay in 2 movies and a TV series, you were initially very hesitant to talk about your own sexuality.
People really need to understand that actors have no obligation to anybody to tell anybody about their personal lives. And the fact that an actor takes on a role in a gay project does not mean that that opens his bedroom door to the world. That means that he's playing a role. Get over it.
So what do you say about the rumors that you're black?
Yeah, how about that one? Let's start with that big rumor. Yeah, when I finally decided to just let it be public, it wasn't because of feeling any pressure about being black, no, about my sexuality being a big secret. It was because I just was tired of talking around the issue, and people brought it up in every single interview. I've been very comfortable with myself for a long, long time, so having to talk around the issue was exhausting and sort of it just felt stupid. And at this point, I feel like once I did an interview for Instinct magazine, I was in the Out 100 last year, 2007. I don't need to talk about it anymore. It's done. There's the information. There you go.
You're onto your family?
Since I was 18. No one had any questions. It wasn't a big secret to anyone in my family.
What do you want audiences to take away from the film?
What's great about the film, to me, is that it highlights this big gay wedding is not dramatic for any of the reasons that the right wing wants to make it dramatic. It's not about weird sex or whatever. I don't know what they're, I still don't know what they're caught up on. I don't know what this Proposition 8 is even about. It's about these friends who get together with their friend who's making the decision to commit himself to his lover for the rest of his life. And all the drama that comes up is about their relationships, their very human relationships. And it feels silly to even say at this point, but it humanizes gay marriage. Of course it's human, but I mean, but at this point it feels like people still don't understand. They're just people getting married. They're people who are in love committing themselves. Why is it such a big deal for you to let somebody get married? So to an extent, I think, you know, we're preaching to the choir because fans of the show are obviously people who are cool with gay people being in love and expressing that love. But hopefully there's enough of a buzz around the film that people who were not necessarily fans of the show and were not necessarily super pro-gay at the beginning of the day will go see the movie. And hopefully their eyes will be opened about the fact that gay people are people and they deserve the rights that you have. And, you know, what I think is also important about this particular story and these particular guys is they're living their lives very openly. There's a lot of talk about HIV and AIDS on the show, and there's one of the characters, Alex, played by Rodney Chester. He has a clinic, an HIV AIDS clinic. And having characters like this on television and in films who are very open and honest about their lives and their sex lives hopefully encourages people in the black community to allow themselves and people in their families to be open about their lives and their sex lives so that this HIV epidemic that is ravaging not only the gay, the black community, but also women in the black community, because of all these secrets and lies that the black church is encouraging black same-sex loving people to tell. They want black people to stay in the closet, and it's not serving the black community for black gay people to stay in the closet. And I think having a story with these black men expressing their love openly, without shame, without, and having their families come and support them as well, I think that's a big step. I think it's really important right now for people to see that, because we just can't afford to keep these lies going. We can't afford to be stigmatizing and ostracizing same-sex loving people in our community because it's killing us. So hopefully Noah's Ark helps to change that.
Well, do you guys think it's okay to stop using condoms after you're married?
That's tricky. I mean, I have all these young guys come sweeping through the clinic after they've only known the guy less than a week. Talking about, I love him, I trust him, he does a lot of nice things for me. I'm like, trust him? Girl, you're the one that's going to be sitting at the HIV clinic looking stupid.
But isn't it a lot more complicated when you're talking about a long-term relationship?
You and Trey still use condoms?
We did the first 5 years, but we got tested regularly. And do you guys know that we're going on year 11?
Wow.
You guys believe that? And he's never cheated.
Aww.
That you know of.
Well, what about you and Eddie?
Oh, we still use condoms. I think it's more hygienic.
Well, I guess we can hold off. Maybe we'll revisit our options after a few years of blissful monogamy.
This is my conversation with actor Daryl Stevens. Noah's Ark, Jumping the Broom is a Logo Features release. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
I've been trying to find a way to tell you what I really want to say, but I've been too afraid to open up and let you see the way I feel inside.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Donna Ann Ward, Lee Moore, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, John Frame, Sherry Lunn, and Steve Pride contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can hear our podcasts or subscribe to postal mail CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappella and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening. On 2UUU, Nowra, New South Wales, KMUD&E, Garberville and Eureka, California, WJSC, Johnson, Vermont, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The race for the White House has been a long and winding road for Senators Barack Obama and John McCain. At each step of the way, there have been complaints of media bias in the coverage of the candidates. The Project for Excellence in Journalism has been tracking campaign news since January 2007. Its new report, Winning the Media Campaign, analyzes coverage between September 8th and October 16th, that crucial time coming out of the conventions and through the four debates. Associate Director Mark Jerkowitz says the data doesn't provide conclusive answers on the question of candidate bias, but it does show one media bias.
The one bias we can clearly detect is that winning begets winning. And that campaigns that seem to have a positive strategic dynamic, i.e. they're winning in the polls, they appear to be doing well, generally get better coverage.
The analysis shows that press treatment of Barack Obama has been somewhat more positive than negative, but not markedly so. On the other hand, coverage of John McCain has been heavily unfavorable since the second week of the study.
Negative stories don't mean that the authors of those stories are in some ways necessarily writing op-ed pieces that say, I love this guy and I don't like the other guy. They're stories that contain assertions that are negative about the campaign. And as we see, frankly, many of those assertions are really about strategic aspects of the campaign. Not surprisingly, and I don't think it'll shock anybody, more than 50% of the coverage that we looked at in this period was about what we call horse race issues, which is, you know, who's winning, who's losing, polling, strategy, tactics, and only 20% of the coverage was really about policy issues and differences.
The study describes the echo effect of each story, where a behavior or gaffe is first reported. Then the media will measure the political impact of the event, the candidate will comment, and that comment gets analyzed.
What we've very much seen in this campaign is a very episodic coverage that kind of lurches from event to event, controversy to controversy. Part of that is probably because, you know, there is kind of this tendency on the part of the media to focus in on the horse race and then to start to evaluate things on the basis of, could this be a strategic game changer?
On the plus side, because there has been so much coverage, people who have been paying attention can be reasonably well informed on the issues.
There's a lot of sort of where the candidates stand on the issues that's part and parcel of this coverage, even if it's not dominant. I think one thing the media have done pretty well in this campaign is doing a more aggressive job of vetting and fact-checking claims by both candidates. So I think there have been positive aspects.
Jerkowitz likes the fact that news sources are actually breaking stories. But with so many media outlets, there has been a fragmenting of the news and an increase in the partisanship of media coverage.
Some of the biggest scoops in the primary season were done by a reporter for the Huffington Post and a blogger. But if we are living in a country where we're going to have a red media and a blue media, that may be more problematic for us in the future.
For more information about the Project for Excellence in Journalism, go to journalism.org.
What is the scariest thing about the media?
I never know if they're telling the truth.
It's hard to pick. So many things go through my head.
Corrupt ownership and corrupting power.
How badly does its job of informing people and how skewed people's views of the world and our country and our politics and our policies are?
They don't always tell the truth.
Corporate control.
They tell scary stories that don't matter to anybody, except if you're interested in what to wear, what to say, or where to be.
I would say the scariest thing about the media would be all of the makeup that the anchors wear. You can't really tell what their expressions really are because there's just so much foundation going on.
On
The scariest thing about the media is the National Association of Broadcasters and their dirty tricks they're sending to the FCC to try to stop white spaces from opening up.
The quality of our journalism has sunk so low that I don't trust the information I get.
No!
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. In our top spin, why not kick your opponents when they're down? At least, that seems to be the attitude of the Employment Policies Institute, an anti-labor front group. After Republicans accused Acorn of voter fraud, the Employment Policies Institute ran a full-page ad in the New York Times, accusing Acorn of union busting, failing to pay its employees the minimum wage, and misusing government grants. What is the Employment Policies Institute? It's one of several front groups run by industry lobbyist Rick Berman. For years, EPI has fought Acorn campaigns to increase the minimum wage at the state and national levels. EPI said it ran the ad to show that Acorn's, quote, corrupt and fraudulent practices, end quote, don't stop at voter registration. Acorn denies the industry-funded group's accusations.
A well-connected exile group with high-level Republican Party contacts spending lots of money on public relations. Sound familiar? Except this time, it's not Iraq. It's Iran. The Council for a Democratic Iran recently hired the Livingston Group, a lobbying and PR firm. The Virginia-based group paid the firm $300,000 in the third quarter of 2008 alone. Its Livingston Group lobbyists include Lori Fitzpagato, who helped sell the first Gulf War when she worked at Hill & Knowlton. The founder and head of the Council for a Democratic Iran is Dr. Behrouz Behboudi. He's an oil entrepreneur who was born in Iran and is a personal friend of Iran-Contra figure Oliver North and Christian Coalition founder Pat Robertson. In 2007, Behboudi warned that if Iran's leaders didn't change their stance soon, quote, what happened to Saddam Hussein will happen in Iran, too, end quote.
They seem like ads from a liberal advocacy group.
They look to us to protect them, teach them, tuck them in at night. But for parents without health insurance, a visit to the doctor could be more than they can afford. So in Congress, Arlen Specter and Bob Casey helped pass health care coverage for uninsured children.
But surprise, the ads were actually paid for by the pharmaceutical industry. Why is an industry group spending more than $13 million on ads praising Democrats who supported a children's health care bill? For two reasons. The drug industry knows it doesn't have a good public image, and Democrats will likely increase their control of Congress in 2009. The main drug industry group, Pharma, has also shifted its political donations. For years, Pharma donated overwhelmingly to Republicans. It's now splitting its campaign contributions between the two major parties. Pharma's also working with unions to support universal health care bills at the state and local levels. The head of an industry-funded health care advocacy group explained, quote, I think they realize that the only way to have any serious respect is to start working towards solving the health care problems, end quote.
The United States has been harshly criticized for some of its PR campaigns in Iraq. Now an Iraqi political party is launching its own PR effort in the United States. The Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq plans to spend $20,000 a month to educate U.S. policymakers and the general public about, quote, Iraqi Islamic culture. The Bush administration supports the party, which is a powerful part of the opposition to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's group. The Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq is also supported by the Iranian government.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Faken, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned lobbyist Rick Berman. Berman's lobbying firm works for major food, alcohol, and tobacco companies, many of which also fund his front groups. The front groups, in turn, pay Berman's lobbying firm for management services. Berman once explained that his goal is to discredit the labor, environmental, and health groups, often at odds with his industry clients. Activists, quote, drive consumer behavior on meat, alcohol, fat, sugar, tobacco, and caffeine, he explained, so he must, quote, attack their credibility. Berman's many front groups include the Employment Policies Institute, the Center for Consumer Freedom, the American Beverage Institute, and the Center for Union Facts.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of November 1st, 2008. I'm Anna Maria Roque. Starting with the good news, cheers, China makes progress. The 10th National Women's Congress in Beijing was held on October 28th and reported that significant progress for Chinese women's rights have taken place over the past 5 years, including the creation of 27,000 agencies for women and children. The government called upon women from around the country to attend Congress and draft a blueprint for women's progress for the next 5 years. Chinese women are increasingly becoming police, judges, models, and politicians, and currently account for 45% of the paid workforce. The government is also trying to increase women's involvement in state affairs and social economic development, as well as eliminating discrimination and the gender income gap. The Chinese government has long been criticized by international human rights groups for its human rights record, including the enforcement of its one-child law. More news to cheer this week. Iraq's female lawmakers are slowly gaining power. USA Today reports that female legislators comprised 25% of the parliament, but were often relegated to soft issues such as family law. Now they are increasingly speaking out and influencing committee meetings. One sign of change came when women boycotted a parliamentary session after a comment by Parliament Speaker Mahmoud al-Mashhadani saying women make poor leaders because they are easily distracted by worries that their husband might take a second wife. Muslim American women are encouraged by their communities to run for political office, and their number has significantly increased as a result. The Associated Press reports that prior to September 11, less than 5% of Muslim political candidates were women. Now it's about 1 in 3. The world's largest female-only institution of higher learning, the Riyadh Women's University in Saudi Arabia, is expanding and will include 13 colleges and a 700-bed teaching hospital. Officials laid the hospital's first stone on October 29th, and the university has already enrolled 17,000 students. Havaria Fatah, a Muslim professor, has been nominated to the post of imam in a southern Belgian mosque. Fatah is believed to be the first female imam in Europe. Female playwrights are holding a town meeting on November 3rd to denounce gender inequity in the theater industry. The New York Times reports that leading off-Broadway plays are 4 times more likely to be written by men than by women. Now for the downside of news, jeers, soldiers report sex assault. A study released on October 28 by the Veterans Administration shows that 14.5% of female veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan reported rape, assault, and sexual harassment during military service. 76% of those women were diagnosed with a mental illness such as depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or drug addiction. Female soldiers experience rape rates nearly 3 times higher than women in the general population. More news to jeer this week. A 23-year-old woman was buried up to her neck and stoned to death in Somalia after an Islamic Sharia court found her guilty of adultery. This is the first such public killings by militants in about 2 years. Issa Momeni, a graduate student at Northridge campus of California State University and a dual U.S.-Iranian citizen, has been arrested in Tehran and faces accusations over her involvement with a women's rights equality campaign. Momeni traveled to Iran to carry out research for her thesis on women's rights. Reuters reports that a new government study shows that women with a disability are more likely to experience a physical assault by relatives and partners than those without a disability. 37% of women with disabilities report abuse compared to 20% of women without disabilities. West Hollywood residents reported a hate crime when they saw a doll of Governor Sarah Palin hanging by a noose in a Halloween display. The Los Angeles Times reports Mayor Jeffrey Prang calling the display problematic and said that it should be removed. The Sheriff's Department said that a hate crime definition was inappropriate. Also noted in the news this week, Tzipi Livni, elected to lead Israel's Kadima Party and the acting Prime Minister, failed to form a coalition government this week, thereby reducing her chances to become the nation's next Prime Minister. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency reports that she could still become Prime Minister if her party is elected to retain power. In memoriam, Edith Evans Asbury died in her New York home on October 30th. Asbury started out as a reporter in 1929 and eventually joining the Metro staff of the New York Times in 1952. While at the Times, she audited courses at Columbia University School of Law after she was denied admission because of her gender. She explained later that she had no intentions of practicing law, but believed that training would make her a better reporter. Asbury was a close friend of Rita Hanley Jensen, founder of Women's E-News, and hundreds of other women from each of the generations who followed her lead into the field of journalism. Sally Udelman, a senior scholar at the International Center for Research on Women, died last week from brain cancer. Udelman was a lifelong advocate for women's economic development, and her research focused on women in Latin America. These news briefs were compiled by Julia Anglehescu. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. Background music is by Joan Hickley. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yin Radio. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Anumaraya Roque.
Workers' Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Association of Machinists Workers will vote Saturday on a tentative agreement ending their 52-day-old Boeing strike. The union says it secured health care benefits with no additional cost shifting to workers, preserved defined benefit pensions for all members of the union, and improved those pensions. The IAM also says the new agreement guarantees a 15% pay raise over the 4-year proposed contract. The union also says it won its fight for job security. Full details of the tentative agreement have not yet been made public. The strike had cost Boeing an estimated $100 million a day in lost production and sales. 27,000 workers are covered under that tentative agreement. SPIA, the union representing more than 20,000 engineers and tech workers at Boeing, began their contract talks this week. SPIA Executive Director Ray Goforth says Boeing is trying to take away bargaining despite huge financial success.
This is a company that is fabulously successful financially, fabulously successful in the marketplace, and instead of seeking to reward the employees that delivered that success, they're seeking takeaways that you would expect from a company that was struggling to survive.
The AFL-CIO and its community affiliate, Working America, say they're unleashing an unprecedented Final Four get-out-the-vote effort in the final 4 days of this election to reach more than 13 million union voters in 21 presidential battleground states. Tens of thousands of AFL-CIO volunteers will go into action door-to-door Saturday in an effort to reach 3.9 million union households, make 5.5 million calls, and distribute more than 2 million leaflets at work sites through Election Day. Change to Win is actively turning out its members. The two labor federations pledged to cooperate politically in this election cycle. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney says that labor's effort is the result of work by hundreds of thousands of union volunteers. Working America, the 2.5 million member community affiliate of the AFL-CIO, has 1,000 full-time canvassers in 11 battleground states to maximize worker voter turnout on November 4th. Could the third time be the charm for workers at the country's largest pork processing plant seeking union recognition? Jesse Russell reports.
The United Food and Commercial Workers Union has been trying to organize workers at the Smithfield Food Slaughterhouse in North Carolina for more than 15 years. Two prior votes failed to win a majority in favor, but the union has charged that the company used illegal union busing tactics during those votes to intimidate workers. The UFCW has since waged a campaign against the company, which has included boycotts and publicity concerning the atmosphere at the slaughterhouse. In response, Smithfield filed a racketeering and extortion suit against the union that was scheduled to go to trial Monday morning. However, the two sides met prior to the start of the hearings and reached a settlement. The terms of the agreement include setting terms for a new union election, and in exchange, the union will end its campaign against the company. A date for the third vote will be set after the two sides agree on terms.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy.
Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
The Democrats and their standard bearer are co-enablers of the biggest single heist ever perpetrated on the United States public, second only to the 60-year-long military-industrial shakedown that is a permanent fixture of the American criminal landscape. Bailout 2, the injection of what will become trillions of public dollars into the nation's largest banks, is purposely designed to allow the bigger financial pirates to eat up the smaller ones, thus creating an even more condensed oligarchy of institutions that will be judged too big to fail. Consequently, these banks' power to extort further infusions of the people's finite reservoir of wealth in the future will become permanent. According to published reports, part of the Bush regime's plan is to drive consolidation of the banking industry. Henry Paulson, whose title is Treasury Secretary, but who is in fact acting as an agent for his former firm, Goldman Sachs, and other vectors of capitalist chaos, has been permitted to divert every available ounce of public wealth to creation of financial monopoly. It is a huge step in the erection of a fascist, let me repeat the word because I don't use it lightly, a permanent fascist infrastructure of rule by the most rapacious, non-productive sector of capitalism. The Bush regime is determined to make these structural changes irreversible. They are betting that even if the Democrats find the courage to demand a public presence in the banks that leech on the public purse, a small cabal of mega bankers will have been empowered to act as untouchables, too big to fail, or even to effectively threaten. Even as late-stage capitalism convulses in the throes of its own now insurmountable contradictions, its grip on the American state apparatus and economy tightens. We can now see the outlines of a raw dictatorship of leaner and meaner, more aggressively ruthless lords of capital, a class personified by the bullying, blustering Henry Paulson. This configuration of banks, subsidized with public dollars and directed by corporate strategists sometimes posing as public servants, will not hesitate to manipulate crises to its own benefit and to wield its power to create chaos at will as a weapon. This looming structural threat, in combination with the firmly embedded military-industrial extortionists, poses as grave a danger to society as the concentrated power of organized slaveholders 150 years ago. Indeed, it is an even greater threat since there is no significant organized opposition. Certainly not from the Democratic Party and their congressional leader, Nancy Pelosi. The Democrats opened the door to trillions in gifts to big capital while asking only $150 to $300 billion in economic assistance for the people. They have always settled on the public's behalf for the pitiful small slice of the people's own pie. In a crisis, the Democrats show their true calling. They are doormen for the rich. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Capitalism is known as the anarchy of capitalist production. It's based on individual corporations, individual capitalists, drive for self-improvement, and cross your fingers and maybe it all works out. And crossing your fingers didn't work too well this time.
Dr. Patty Quick is the chair of Economics History and Political Science Department at San Francisco College. With the ongoing repudiation of the free market ideology, she hinted at why socialist analysis may provide a coherent alternative. Real assets, produced by the hands of workers, she says, gave way to abstract financial assets and derivatives, which became the market. The problem was that
the major banking institutions did not know what was in these derivatives. They were so convoluted that it was impossible to figure out what was in them. They called them toxic assets. Now, the banks have these crazy pieces of paper.
When the housing bubble finally burst, financial institutions and banks started to default, everyone stopped lending, and a credit freeze ensued, which is now threatening the entire economy.
The way corporations, the way business works, is that they have what's called revolving debt. They borrow and pay out for payroll for 4 weeks, and they pay it back, and then they borrow again. But the bank says this time, oops, sorry. The whole financial system froze. And what that meant was that real businesses had to stop real production.
And the obvious remedy to the laissez-faire of the past 28 years is that
socialism is working class control over production and control over government.
Mark Engler is an analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus, a writer and author of How to Rule the World, The Coming Battle Over the Economy. He gave the rationale for socialist politics.
The technocrats have been claiming larger and larger portions of our public decision-making as their own specialized domain. Decisions about public spending, what kind of jobs we should have, what sort of relation our country is going to have to other countries in the world, all of these are being claimed as specialized economic decisions. And I think that we need to reclaim that.
And while in the U.S. the economy is now on everyone's mind,
the rest of the world has been experiencing what I call the crisis of market fundamentalism for at least 10 years now. In 1997, we had the Asian financial crisis. Many of the same factors were at work here. There was a process of deregulation, opening up the markets. Capital could rush in. It could speculate on real estate prices, gamble on whatever it wanted. And then at the push of a button, the moment they got spooked, they could pull out. In December of 2001, we had the collapse of Argentina's economy.
By now, most countries have disengaged from corporate globalization. The Bush administration's policies have more to do with imperial globalization. There will be a battle for the economic soul of Barack Obama, Mark Engler says. On one side, people like Robert Rubin, the architect of Bill Clinton's neoliberal policies, and on the other, a new grassroots base.
That base is demanding a new type of trade and development policy. It's rejected these so-called free trade agreements. It's demanding a new type of economic policy.
For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
I consider it part of my mission in life to get people to eat vegetables they think they don't like. It's always been amazing to me to wait on a table and see a grown adult turning their nose up at any vegetable other than, say, a green bean. First, I wonder why they think green beans are so great, and then I wonder what on earth they're feeding their children if they don't eat vegetables themselves. This is a dangerous rabbit hole to start down, so let's keep the focus today on the hated vegetable at hand, which is the humble Brussels sprout. Once upon a time, I didn't like Brussels sprouts, but then I discovered that if you introduce bacon to pretty much any green vegetable, particularly of the cruciferous variety, meaning anything basically from the cabbage family, it will be delicious. Later this week, I'm going to try a vegetarian alternative, and I'll keep you posted on the results. So, how to make Brussels sprouts delicious? The basic tenets are light cooking, hot cooking, flavorful fat, and caramelization. Start off by trimming your Brussels sprouts by cutting the stem end just a little bit. Leave most of the stem intact. Remove the outer leaves from the sprout and cut it in half. You may cut extra large sprouts into quarters and keep really small sprouts whole. Steam the sprouts for about 5 to 6 minutes and rinse with cold water to stop the cooking. In a large saute pan or a wok, I like to use nonstick here. Render some cubed bacon over medium heat. I usually calculate about one slice per person, plus that extra slice for snacking on while you're cooking. Use really good bacon here, such as the double-smoked, extra-thick bacon from Blues Creek Farms in the North Market. When the bacon is nearly crisp, drain off most of the bacon fat and add just a pinch of butter, about a tablespoon. Turn the heat to high and place the sprouts in a pan, cut side down. Sprinkle them with salt and pepper and allow to sit without moving them for about 4 minutes until they are nicely browned. Then give everything a toss to make sure the sprouts are hot all the way through and everything is lightly coated in butter and the bacon is evenly distributed. I defy you to try this method and still hate Brussels sprouts. I'll give you a few more ideas over the next few episodes. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS LPFM 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
My thanks to Mike Cannon at WNRB in Wausau, Wisconsin, who rebroadcast World Report.
Welcome to Media Minutes.
Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of cheap oil.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers...
This Week in Radical History for the week of April 7th.
My name is Scooter, and this is the Inner Side Radio Program.
This week in Palestine, the service of the International Middle East Media Center.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out on WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin.
All these programs and more can be heard each week on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m., right here on Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau. Free people, free radio.